Hi, I'm Mike Maris, and this is the Tax Update Podcast for the week of October 29th, 2007. Let's start this off with Notice 2007-88. Under existing rules, a client who wants to change the method of accounting can use either the automatic consent provided by RevProc 2002-9 or can request the service to approve a change of accounting method. Many practitioners have complained that this method, which has been around almost since the 1954 code, is inefficient and very much outdated. Well, apparently the IRS agrees, because Notice 2007-88 requests comments on a proposed restructuring of the accounting method change process. Instead of the automatic and non-automatic consent procedures, there will be three procedures: the standard consent, specific consent, or letter ruling consent. The standard consent process would generally replace the current automatic method change method. Form 3115 would be filed with the client's tax return and would have to comply with whatever other procedures governing the process the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service adds to the process. However, there'd be no user fee and no letter ruling would be issued by the IRS. The good news about this is that the IRS anticipates that most accounting method changes would now be made using this standard consent process. Not only would it be available for the specific changes covered in RevProc 2002-9 or any of the succeeding revenue procedures identifying these, but it would also be available for other changes that were not specifically identified to date. Further, if a 3115 was appropriately filed, the client would receive both audit protection and consent, even though no official ruling was going to be issued. Now, an interesting twist in the standard consent process is that the IRS would review the Forms 3115 to determine whether or not the form was properly completed and whether or not there was a problem with the requested accounting method change. If there was a problem, the IRS would deny consent, but the taxpayer would be notified of the fact that consent was not granted. However, the IRS at this point does not intend to permit taxpayers to perfect improperly completed Forms 3115. Unfortunately, this means that a taxpayer filing an incomplete Form 3115 would not receive either ruling protection or audit protection. Further, the taxpayer would not be deemed to have received consent for the change of accounting method. Even with these caveats, however, the standard consent method appears to be a much welcomed improvement over the old automatic consent process. The second method is the specific consent method. Under this method, the IRS would publish guidance in the Internal Revenue Bulletin that would list specific accounting method changes that must be made using the specific consent process. Now, if a method was not listed, it should be somewhat presumed that one could change the method of accounting by using the standard consent process. And that appears to be the intent of Notice 2007-88. The rules for filing the specific consent request are going to be about the same as for filing the current non-automatic accounting method change request. The Form 3115 must be filed by the last day of the ninth month of the requested taxable year of change, with no possibility for late requests provided generally under Regulation 301.9100. However, if a late request is received, the IRS will treat it as appropriately filed for the next succeeding tax year. Also, if the taxpayer wants a specific condition that is different from the standard consent process, that request can also be made using the specific consent process. The final process is a letter ruling request. This is for taxpayers who want the IRS National Office to rule on the propriety of their particular accounting method change request. This is going to be an extremely formal process. A fully developed ruling must be submitted to the Internal Revenue Service. A user fee would have to be paid, and the IRS would treat it just as they do any other letter ruling request. How is the IRS going to implement these proposed changes? Well, Notice 2007-88 indicates the IRS will implement a pilot program before making any permanent changes to the existing automatic consent versus non-automatic consent process. The IRS is also actively seeking comments on the process, as well as suggestions to improve the process. Our next item is Letter Ruling 2007-42010. This ruling involves a charitable organization that, for cash or other property, provides gift annuities to donors. The annuities use annuity rates set by the American Council on Gift Annuities. Now, the charitable organization wanted to issue two special kinds of deferred gift annuities, known as flexible gift annuities. The flexible annuities provide the donor can start receiving an annuity based upon the donor's election. In any event, however, because the annuity rates will be set by referring to an age-based schedule, the actuarial value of the remainder interest will be the same no matter when the donor elects to begin receiving the annuity. After reciting a detailed discussion of the provisions of IRC Section 72 and Reg 1.72, the IRS in this ruling concluded that no amount will be constructively received by the annuity recipient until the annuity recipient actually begins receiving the annuity payments. However, the ruling was very narrowly limited to the facts expressed in the ruling, and also the ruling made it clear that it was not reaching any conclusion on whether or not the contracts themselves constituted annuities pursuant to the provisions of IRC Section 72. In short, the ruling concludes, if these are true annuities, then there's no income until the recipient actually begins receiving the money. The IRS also issued another interesting letter ruling. Letter ruling 2007-42004 deals with the question of whether a corporate payment to settle a securities class action lawsuit is a deductible expense under Section 172. In short, is it an ordinary and necessary business expense? Now, the facts of the case are that the corporation was the target of a class action suit alleging violations of Sections 11 and 12A2 of the Securities Act of 1933, Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, and Rule 10B-5, promulgated under the Act. Also, the suit alleged various violations of state securities laws and common law. The fundamental question addressed here was whether or not this was a capital-type transaction that would have required the capitalization of the various costs. In concluding that the costs were deductible as ordinary and necessary business expenses, the letter ruling discussed the differences between capitalized costs incurred as a result of acquiring assets and ordinary and necessary business expenses. Essentially, the ruling looked at the origin of the claim and concluded that the transactions were rooted in the taxpayer's ordinary and necessary business activities. Further, all of the allegations arose from the reporting of earnings, assets, etc. in the financial statements and not from any particular stock offerings. Concluding that all of the allegations arose from the filing of registration statements, financial reports, SEC filings, press releases, etc., the ruling concluded, as mentioned, that these were out of the ordinary conduct of a trade of business and as such could be deductible. Staying with the IRS for a little while, one of the hottest topics procedurally is the issue of whether or not the IRS can seek access to work papers, which work papers they can get, and so forth. Two developments this week are worth noting. First, the IRS announced it was going to appeal the district court decision in the Textron case, rejecting the IRS request for access to work papers. If you remember, the Textron case concluded that because the work papers had been prepared in anticipation of litigation, contained basically no factual material, and represented the attorney's view of potential litigation risks, they were subject to the prepared in anticipation of litigation privilege, and thus the IRS couldn't get their hands on them. While initially viewed as a big victory for the taxpayers, the IRS has continually stated that it thinks this decision will be overturned on appeal. A secondary issue is how the IRS will continue to deal with the entire question of work paper access. In a speech before tax executives, Acting IRS Commissioner Linda Stiff indicated that there were no current plans to change the policy of restraint in seeking taxpayer work papers during audits, and that includes the FIN 48 work papers. Commissioner Stiff indicated that the FIN 48 work papers that would not be available or includable in publicly available filings would be requested only in accordance with Section 4.10.20.3 of the Internal Revenue Manual, which provides that the IRS will ask for tax accrual work papers only in unusual circumstances or, of course, where there is a listed transaction. The next item provides some welcome news for taxpayers with non-qualified deferred compensation plans subject to Section 409 Cap A. The IRS in Notice 2007-86 extended to December 31, 2008, the transitional relief that was scheduled to expire on December 31, 2007. Notice 2007-86 provides that taxpayers are not required to comply with the requirements of the Section 409 Cap A final regulations during 2008. However, they are required to operate their non-qualified deferred compensation plans in compliance with the plan's terms, so long as they're consistent with Section 409 Cap A and any applicable guidance. Now, the most applicable guidance is probably going to be Notice 2005-1, where, for example, a provision of Notice 2005-1 is inconsistent with the final regulations, taxpayers may rely on either Notice 2005-1 or the final regulations. Where the issue is not addressed anywhere, well, taxpayers have to use a reasonable good faith interpretation of the statute. If they elect to rely on the regulations, well, that's a reasonable good faith interpretation of the statute. Unfortunately, with a couple of limited exceptions, taxpayers cannot rely on the proposed regulations for periods after December 31, 2007. As I indicated, this transition relief is very much welcomed by practitioners and taxpayers alike and reflects the ongoing problems and issues that the complexity of Section 409 Cap A brings into the deferred compensation arena. Exempt organizations have been receiving a lot of focus from the IRS lately. And in some good news, the IRS in IR 2007-176 announced that it was going to hold workshops for small and mid-size 501c3 exempt organizations this winter and next spring. The workshops will be held in Salt Lake City, Utah, Columbia, South Carolina, Sacramento, California, Arlington, Virginia, Austin, Texas, and Columbus, Ohio, all on different dates. The workshops will basically describe what these organizations must do to maintain their tax-exempt status and obviously meet any tax obligations. The workshop will also cover the benefits and responsibilities of exempt organizations and actions that could jeopardize that status, unrelated business income items, employment issues, and an explanation of the Form 990 filings, including an explanation of the new e-postcard filing. Each workshop will be limited to 200 attendees and will be filled on a first-come, first-served basis. There is a non-refundable fee of $45, which will include a text and IRS forms and publications. Pre-registration is required. To register, go to the Charities and Nonprofits page on the IRS website at www.irs.gov/EO and click on the calendar of events link. Information and registration can also be obtained by calling the IRS registration services provider. Let's take a look at a decision from the tax court. In Diaz versus Commissioner, TC Memo 2007-317, Diaz was requesting a reimbursement of litigation costs because he had substantially prevailed in his litigation with the IRS. Unfortunately, the court noted that much of the documentation was not really substantiated until trial. For example, a number of the individuals that Diaz referenced on checks and other documentation provided little reference as to who they were until litigation. Most of the signatures on the checks were legible, and the signatures that were legible were not those of Diaz. The court concluded that prior to litigation, the IRS was certainly reasonable in deciding that there was a question about who had actually paid the expenses, since the issue of whether the IRS acted reasonably turns upon the available information used to form the IRS's position. The court concluded that based on the evidence, the IRS certainly acted reasonably when it disallowed the deductions. So, unfortunately, Mr. Diaz was denied his request for litigation expenses. This week also saw Treasury issuing final regulations under IRC Section 368, which of course is the reorganization provisions, certainly one of the more complicated sections of the Internal Revenue Code. These regulations continue the IRS and Treasury's extension of the rules regarding transfers of assets or stock following a tax-free reorganization, so long as the transaction preserves the continuity of ownership between former target shareholders and the target business assets. This is achieved by expanding the definition of a qualified group, as well as the definition of who may be a party to a reorganization. The final regulations permit aggregation of stock ownership within a qualified group, which had been previously defined. This makes it a little bit easier to meet the continuity of business tests for corporate restructurers. In another change, the regulations provide that if a qualified group holds an appropriate control interest in a partnership, stock owned by the partnership is treated as owned by members of the group. Also, the final regulations adopt the proposed regulation rule dealing with subsequent transfers of assets or stock. The bottom line, so long as the continuity of business enterprise requirement is satisfied and the distributions or transfers qualify as distributions, then a subsequent transfer of assets or stock will not jeopardize the tax-free nature of a reorganization under IRC Section 368. Back to the IRS, in Letter Ruling 2007-42026, the IRS addressed the question of whose life expectancy can be used to calculate the minimum required distribution from an IRA. In this case, there was no designated beneficiary in the IRA form, and the service was reluctant and in fact declined to provide that even though a beneficiary was named in the will and the IRA would pass to the estate, that qualified as the same as a designated beneficiary. Thus, the daughter's life expectancy could not be used for purposes of determining the minimum required distribution, and the IRA had to be paid out over the remaining life of the IRA owner, since the distributions had already started. A significant problem facing the Internal Revenue Service is how to close the tax gap, the difference between what individuals report and pay and what they should be reporting and paying. Well, the IRS has come up with a strategy designed to reduce the tax gap. The strategy? Combine better taxpayer service with a lot tougher enforcement and attempt to use technology to better identify areas of non-compliance, while acknowledging that there's a lot of money through non-compliant small businesses and self-employed individuals, the IRS also recognizes that a lot of money is being lost offshore. An ongoing problem will be identifying those who are trying to comply but simply can't or fail to because of the complexity of the tax law, and those who don't want to comply. International issues will continue to be a big target for the IRS, including, for the first time, a sampling of how U.S. expatriates are complying with the tax law. Of course, technology will play an increasing role in taxpayer compliance as the IRS seeks to utilize a variety of different databases and new technology improvements to better identify those taxpayers who are not compliant. Our final item today takes us up to Capitol Hill and to what is probably going to be the opening shot in tax reform warfare between the Democrats and the Republicans. Ways and Means Committee Chairman Charles Rangel introduced the Tax Reduction and Reform Act of 2007 this past week. That bill is touted as comprehensive tax reform, and in fact it has quite a few interesting provisions. Now, in addition to the one-year AMT patch and what is becoming the annual extender package, which will probably be split off and dealt with separately given the time sensitivity of these pieces of legislation, the Tax Reduction and Reform Act of 2007 offers a complete repeal of the individual alternative minimum tax. Now, the revenue offset for that is a 4% to 4.6% surcharge on capital gains and dividends for single filers with AGIs of over $150,000 and for married couples filing a joint return with AGIs over $200,000. Additionally, and this is some good news for small businesses, the bill would permanently extend the current enhanced Section 179 asset expensing rules. Of course, without further congressional action, these rules were set to go back to $25,000 in 2011. Additionally, the bill would cut the corporate tax rate from 35% to 30.5%. How are all these benefits going to be paid for? Well, there are a lot of provisions that will take up much of the revenue slack. First, the legislation will change the treatment of carried interest for fund managers. These interests will be taxed at the ordinary income rates and not the lower capital gains rates. This, of course, has created a huge controversy, and we'll have to look to see what happens as this legislation moves forward. Additionally, the legislation would repeal the Section 199 manufacturing deduction. For many, that'll be a welcome repeal of a very complicated provision. However, another revenue raiser is the repeal of the use of the last-in, first-out, or LIFO inventory method. Now, here's where it gets a little interesting. The government estimates this will create about $100 billion, and that's billion with a B, dollars in revenue, while business says it'll be more like $300 billion. Also, there are changes in how various foreign relationships will be taxed, again, principally as a revenue raiser. Now, with the exception of the one-year AMT and extender patch, it's unlikely that this legislation will go anywhere until 2008. And even then, the Republicans have already mounted stiff opposition. In fact, the day before the bill was even introduced, the Republican Study Committee had sent a letter to all House members urging them to reject the proposal. The letter also offered an alternative to repealing the AMT. However, according to the Republican letter, this would not raise taxes on anyone, anywhere, anytime. So as 2007 winds down, the battle lines for 2008 tax reform are already being drawn. Hopefully, however, no matter what happens in 2008, Congress will fix the AMT at least for 2007. And we'll fix it quickly so that taxpayers and practitioners know what the rules are well before the start of tax season. And that wraps up another Tax Update podcast.